updates on previous drilling progress and on construction. They finished the drilling base but recently broke ground near it to start work on a more permanent living structure. Based on Corarium finds, it sounds like they're going to get a colony of Hevitz workers stationed here in the future. But nothing else.
Wait, so they found Corarium?
Toby interrupted.
Tarlo said it didn't exist.
I said which Hazel found conflicting evidence, the doctor clarified. Dylan's brow wrinkled.
Anything else?
Sullivan shook his head. Most of the tabs are out of juice. We've got a bunch of them charging, and if everything was synced properly, that could give us answers. But right now, everything looks pretty basic. Standard reports, standard comm records, then radio silence. But for any privately logged data, the computers are our best bet.
I could try to poke around, Toby offered. See if there's any info that's been logged privately. I don't have clearance for this project, though, and it'll take some time.
Fine. Meanwhile, let's take a rover down to the canyon, Dylan said. Maybe we'll be able to glean a bit more if we survey the drilling setup.
I think we should update Hevitz first, Nova said, glancing at Thea, who'd argued the case earlier. The intern's gaze was downturned now, perhaps too shy to make a stand against Dylan twice. Luckily, Sullivan joined in, offering a gruff,
"Yeah."
"If I wanted your opinions, I'd ask for them," Dylan said. Nova actually laughed. It was as if her body had forgotten formalities and betrayed her. She was used to Dylan being uptight and blunt, but not foolish.
"Is something funny?"
Dylan asked with a glare.
"We've found a few corpses, but no survivors, and Sullivan has drill logs that disturbingly end when Hevitz called us in. Thea already pushed for contacting them on the bridge, and I'm siding with her. We need to update Hevitz. Right now."
Toby muttered something that Nova couldn't quite make out, but it sounded an awful lot like, "You would side with the intern."
"She spared you from a shock blast to the chest, Toby."
"She wouldn't have had to if our captain wasn't so trigger-happy."
"Hey, guys," Thea said.
"And that's Thea's fault?"
Nova continued.
"What is your problem, Toby? Because I'm a temp and she's an intern, we can't possibly be smart or capable? Is it our job titles that offend you or our age? Are you threatened by people who might outshine your mediocrity?"
"Enough!" Dylan roared.
"Guys!" Thea tried again.
"I'm not the one with the mediocre vision barring me from the Aero Force," Toby said.
"You fucking asshole!"
"Will everyone shut up?" Thea yelled. Nova fell silent. So did Toby. In fact, the whole crew went still. Nova had never heard the intern raise her voice, and now she'd just yelled at them. Screamed, really. Behind her visor, Thea's cheeks were flushed with heat.
"I think we should watch this," she said firmly, nodding at the tab they'd found on the bridge.
It had been set on a charging pad, and the cracked screen was now illuminated with data. Everyone huddled nearer. Peering over Thea's shoulder, Nova could make out the following. Sent, July 1st at 14:05 and 45 seconds. From Pitch Evans, Engineer. Number LD-49203. Subject, SOS. Operation, Black Quarry. Location, Achlis, Fringe 1. View coordinates.
"That's barely 5 hours after we entered cryo," Toby said.
Thea let out an exasperated sigh.
"I know. That's why I was trying to get everyone's attention."
"Play it,"
Dylan said, nodding at the arrow icon. Thea reached out and tapped the prompt. Static overtook the screen, flickering before it revealed a choppy shot of a young man sitting against a wall of brushed aluminum, the Hevitz logo stamped into it at even intervals. This was Pitch Evans, Nova realized.
He was still slumped against that command station, only he was now unrecognizable as the man in the video. On screen, sweat coated Evans's brow and dripped from his bangs. The collar of his Hewitt's coveralls was torn, revealing a tattoo of the Union flag on his neck. His head hung forward. Each breath seemed a labor. When he finally looked up at the screen, Nova shuddered. His eyes already seemed empty, sunken.
"It's bad,"
he said, voice husky and pained. The video flickered.
"Lee's dead. The rest of the crew's..."
Another flicker, followed by a long break of black. Then Evans again, panting, grimacing.
"And if you come, don't come without the best scientists. Bring a microbiologist, or a geneticist. Also some guns. Actually, no. If I'm honest..."
The whole of his body twitched with the static, pulled left, then right. The audio faltered, then returned.
"Call Black Quarry off. Forget about Celestial Envoy. And don't ever set foot here again. We're as good as..."
From somewhere off-screen, there was the sound of screeching metal, like a cargo bay opening against its will. Evans's gaze darted from the screen.
"Shit! Shit, shit, shit!"
He leaned back. What felt like ages later, he looked directly at the screen, his eyes boring into Nova.
"Pretend I never sent this. Trust me. It's for the best."
Another shriek of noise, angry and murderous, and the video cut out.
"This is why they sent backup,"
Toby murmured, his face ghost white.
"This came through a few hours after we went under cryo, and they're throwing us to the wolves. The company knows just how bad things are here, and they sent us in anyway."
"We need to abort,"
Sullivan said, his eyes flicking toward Nova. She could see the fear there, how his thoughts were already drifting to his family.
"Damn it, Lo. What have you gotten us into?"
"I don't know," Dylan snapped. "This is news to me, too. Hewitt's never mentioned an SOS transmission when they told me backup was being sent."
"Really?" Sullivan countered. "They sent a specialized backup crew, likely with doctors, just as this SOS calls for, but didn't tell you why those doctors were needed? I bet you saw this exact message in their updates and didn't bother to tell us because you were too worried about your father."
"Are you insinuating that I've kept information from you?" Dylan roared. "That I knowingly risked all our lives?"
Her eyes flashed with authority, and Sullivan fell silent. For a long moment, no one said anything, but Dylan kept glaring at Sullivan in a way that made Nova uncomfortable. The rage that had first sparked through her blue eyes had faded, replaced with something uneasy, something fearful. Dylan's brows remained furrowed. It was almost as if she was terrified Sullivan might repeat his accusations, as though Dylan didn't want the crew thinking too hard about what he'd said. But that couldn't be it. Dylan wouldn't lie about something like this. She was stubborn and proud, but there was no way she could have seen this SOS message in Hewitt's updates and still ordered the crew to case Black Quarry's ship.
"Didn't that drill report mention someone named Lee?"
Cleaver asked, breaking the silence.
"John Lee," Sullivan supplied. "That final drilling log listed him as one of the techs. There was an equipment malfunction. Lee was injured. And then..."
"Complications. Stand by." The men exchanged a worried glance.
"Well, let's get the rover and head down to the drill site," Dylan said.
"Have you lost your mind?" Sullivan said. "You heard what he said. Call Black Quarry off. Pretend I never sent this. He requested scientists and guns."
"Which we have," Dylan interjected, tapping the weapon holstered on her thigh, and then throwing a hand toward Tarlow.
"We need to get our asses back to Odyssey and keep them there."
"And turn our backs on any potential survivors?"
Dylan roared.
They could be out there, Sullivan. My father could be out there. And if the most recent manifest is correct, there were two workers who stayed behind at the drill site when the crew brought Lee to the med bay for his...
She referred to the tab Sullivan had handed her.
Head injury and abrasions.
This was getting out of control. Nova stepped forward.
Look, Dylan, it's been 2 months since that incident, and with all due respect, there's no way those crew members are still out there. There's only one way to know for sure.
Even after the SOS that Hevitz kept from you? Even after Evans's body and the note he left on the floor? It's just plain stupid, and I know you're not stupid.
The captain's chin jutted out, her glare almost daring Nova to continue. Nova had seen this expression before. It came from flight instructors at the academy when a pilot was getting out of line. But this was a line that needed to be crossed, right now, before Dylan led them straight off a cliff.
I have never questioned your orders, Nova went on. I have always listened to every command you've given me. I'm asking you now to consider that maybe your concern for your father is clouding your judgment. We should fall back to Odyssey. Everyone on your crew, everyone, is pushing for us to fall back.
What was the message? Tarlo asked.
Nova had almost forgotten the doctor's presence. The woman was leaning against one of the glass-doored freezers, kneading her hands together anxiously.
From the dead man. Evans, you mentioned a note?
It got in us and most are dead. Declan flew for help. Don't trust the kid, Nova recited. My guess is he was worried the SOS wouldn't get out, so he put a warning on the floor, too.
And then put a bullet through his own brain, said Toby.
A myriad of emotions flicked over the doctor's face, there and gone so fast that Nova couldn't get a good read on any of them.
I don't know why that engineer took his own life, Dylan snapped. Anything we theorize is speculation. But here's what I do know. We were sent here with a job to do, and I am not running back to Odyssey like some spineless coward. We will continue our search for the Black Quarry crew, and we will exercise extreme caution until the backup team relieves us.
Exercise caution? Dr. Tarlo said, pushing off the freezer. Captain, what would make a highly trained Hevitz engineer ask for a microbiologist and a geneticist? Infection? Disease?
The team bristled.
As for the guns he requested, maybe he didn't mean stun weapons. Perhaps he meant weapons like the one he used to end his own life.
A pause.
Now, the SOS requested a microbiologist, and you have one, Tarlo said, touching her own chest. And since Hevitz likely suggested me for your crew because of my previous knowledge of this site, allow me to share some of that knowledge. Ocles is brutal and unforgiving. Its son, F1, is a red dwarf with a luminosity less than 1/100th of what we're used to in the Trios, and our tidally locked position creates a host of problems. Ocles's orbital period is exactly as long as a single rotation. Like a moon to its planet, the same side always faces the sun, which means there are no sunrises or sunsets. The day side is baked out. The night side is essentially in an isolated ice age, and winds constantly blow from the west. There'll be horrific, unpredictable weather. Here in the Terminator, we're somewhat protected, but given our temperature readings, I'd say Black Quarry is positioned along the edge of the night side. That means we're dealing with excessively poor lighting, not just twilight, but something more akin to the final moments of dusk. Plus, aggressive winds and sub-freezing temperatures.
And that's not to mention unpredictable solar flares and sunspots off F1, which can throw Ackley's into a state of blinding light or sudden blackness for weeks on end. Witch Hazel spent a lot of time at this longitude, researching along the night side's edge, and trust me when I say, the last thing you want to test is the power of nature. Bracing her palms against the table, Tarlo leaned forward, exuding a type of authority Nova had never seen from the willowy doctor. Now, if that's not enough reason to exercise caution, how about the fact that nearly an entire Havit's team has seemingly up and vanished? The few employees we've found are all dead. Murdered, it seems. Their rig is trashed, their labs overrun. These samples? Tarlo waved a thumb over her shoulder. Look basic enough. Ackley's version of limestone, shale, and sandstone. The dark samples in the back might even be Carrarium. But we don't know that for certain. Frankly, we know nothing. I strongly suggest you give me time to run tests on these samples and allow Toby a chance to access the systems. We should thoroughly evaluate all the logs before we go running into some canyon where contaminated matter might have been drilled. Dylan eyed the samples, one of which had spilled and frozen all over the freezer's wire shelves.
If that shit is contaminated, she said, I think we're all in a bad place.
We're fine, because we're fully suited, Tarlo replied. But the Black Quarry crew might not have been, not while on Celestial Envoy.
Which is all the more reason to stay put, Nova said in agreement. Wait for the backup crew to land or a debrief to come in from Declan and Hevitz.
It's all the more reason to look for survivors, Dylan said.
With our intercoms down, Tarlo argued. With everything I just told you and our helmets no longer linked, you want to go digging around in Ackley's canyons in the dark?
You're going to get us all killed.
Thea fidgeted beside Nova. Toby let out a nervous laugh.
No one is going to die, Dylan said. Not if we're smart about this. And smart people follow orders. Do I make myself clear?
Silence.
I'll pretend you all said yes. Sullivan, show me everything you found on the drill sites.
As the team dissolved into planning, Thea stood in the doorway of the lab. Dylan had put her on watch, despite it being obvious that there was nothing on Celestial Envoy outside sparking wires, flickering lights, and a few dozen frozen corpses. Thea was vaguely aware of the discussion unfolding behind her. Dr. Tarlo would glean what she could of the still frozen freezer samples while everyone else went to the drill site. Only Sullivan would stay behind. For protection, Dylan had said, despite the fact that Cleaver was the security detail and Thea was the most fit to aid the doctor in any lab work. But she'd heard Sullivan's begging. He hadn't been quiet about it.
I'm not going looking for trouble, Dylan. I won't do it. I've got my boys back home. My wife. Let me stay here and sift through the tabs, see if I can learn anything new.
Did he think his own life was more valuable than everyone else's because he had a family? They were all trying to get home. And while for Thea that meant a foster home, it didn't mean she had nothing to live for. She kneaded her fingers together. Her mother had never seemed farther away.
Orphans don't have mothers, she could hear Toby chiding. By the very definition of the word, your parents are dead.
But there'd been no body, no official close to the missing persons case, and Thea's mother was only presumed dead. That's what her file said, and the social worker Thea was required to meet with every month had been urging Thea to accept her mother's death for years. She couldn't, wouldn't. Not until she hired the galaxy's best private investigator, and they told her otherwise. Thea had been 4, sitting on a bench at a bus stop when she'd last seen her mother. The woman had gone to the bank, Or maybe it had been the pharmacy, or the pawn shop. Thea couldn't remember. All Thea knew then was that when Mommy went off to run an errand, you sat and waited for her to return. Thea sat through the number 4 bus, and the number 17, and then the number 32, number 25, and number 4 again. It started to rain. Dusk set in. And then the cop car had arrived, every millimeter of the water-slicked streets suddenly pulsing red from the vehicle's strobes. "Althea," she told the officer when he asked for her name.
"Where do you live?"
"I don't know." She did. It was just that the car was stolen, and she didn't want to get her mother in trouble.
"Who do you live with? Parents? Grandparents?"
"My mommy."
"What's her name?"
"Mommy." It was actually Naree, but Thea knew her mother sometimes had to do not quite legal things to scrape together meals, and she was worried the cop might lock her up for that instead of reuniting her with her daughter.
"Get in the car,"
the officer said. Thea blinked rainwater from her lashes. "Mommy says I'm not supposed to go with strangers."
"Yeah, well, it doesn't look like your mommy's coming back. And I'm not a stranger. I'm a cop."
He pointed at his badge for emphasis.
"Now get in the car."
It was one of Thea's very first memories. She'd searched long and hard for earlier ones, trying to recall her mother's face or a happier moment. She could see the car they'd called home, the food credits on the dash, a blanket on the back seat. But not her mother. After being placed at the foster apartment in Hearth City, Thea spent the following years searching news articles and scouring the interhub for traces of Naree Sadik. The woman didn't seem to exist. Thea began to wonder if that was even her mother's real name. All Thea knew for certain came from her child services files. Thea was of mainly Turkish and Korean descent. She had O-negative blood and a gluten allergy. Her mother was presumed dead. Still, some small part of Thea believed that if she was good enough, impressive enough, special enough, her mother might find reason to love her again, to reappear. She might come back. It was why Thea had thrown herself into her schoolwork and studying. It was even why she'd first approached Mel. He was 2 years older, also placed at her foster apartment, and she'd asked to borrow his textbooks so she could read up a few levels. Mel was the only good thing about that place. They'd been best friends for years, and then more than friends, and then nothing. Thea was alone again. She had her schooling and her longing for family, and if she ever got back to the Trios, she would find that shadow of a mother and never let her leave again. Because Thea was certain, somehow, deep in her soul, that her mother was out there. If she was dead, Thea would know. She'd feel it.
"Shouldn't we be getting the comms back up before we do this?" Nova argued behind Thea. "I can't do 3 things at once," Toby snapped. "You gotta pick. I go to Odyssey and try to get the comms up, or I stay here and attempt to access the Black Quarry system, or I come with you to the drilling site in case something needs to be hacked or overridden there."
"The last one," Dylan said. "I don't want it to be a wasted trip." Thea steeled herself, squared her shoulders. There was no arguing with Dylan Lowe. If the acting captain wanted to visit the drilling site, the crew would. What concerned Thea was what they might find. Warnings from Pitch Evans's SOS replayed in her mind as well. Requests for a microbiologist or geneticist, and for weapons. Then for the company to simply abandon the entire project. It got in us. Thea's pulse kicked up, and she reminded herself that she was wearing an environmental suit. She was protected. She just had to let Dylan case the drilling site, and then they'd return. The true rescue crew would arrive. She'd go home. One thing at a time.
"Looks like roughly a half-hour ride to the drilling base," Nova said.
She was bent over the tabs, studying what could only be a map, her bronze skin tinged cool by the screen's glow. "Not far from the old Witch Hazel bunker," Dylan agreed. "This blueprint shows a couple drill platforms. We can divide and conquer." She clapped Nova on the shoulder, then straightened from the table. "Let's move. I want to sweep the drilling stations and be back before the sun rises."
"It doesn't rise," Dr. Tarlow said impatiently. "The same side of Aklis constantly faces the sun. It's dusk until we leave this place. Weren't you listening?"
"It was a euphemism. Come on, people." As the crew filed into the hallway and Thea moved to follow, someone squeezed her arm. She spun, startled to see Dr. Tarlow there.
"Be careful, Thea. Hang back, okay? Don't touch anything, not even survivors, if you find them. We have no idea what happened here, and you've got nothing to prove. Let Dylan be the hero."
All Thea could hear was the woman's reassurances the night before they entered stasis. "It's probably something small, an equipment failure, a jammed signal." The doctor's new tone terrified Thea. It was understandable after what they'd learned from the SOS message, but still terrifying.
"I'll be careful,"
she promised, and she meant it. One step at a time, Thea would be painstakingly careful. Lisbeth would have to work quickly. She'd been hypothesizing for years, decades even, and now she could finally act. It wasn't without risk, of course. The crew was running off to the drilling base against her advice, and Sullivan was staying behind with her. If he grew nosy about her work, started asking questions, she'd have to lie. Lisbeth's gaze drifted to the frozen samples in the freezer, to the fridge with the dark seaweed. She didn't want to make things worse. Then again, her decades spent at cold water research sites had yielded nothing. Not yet. And she was here now. She was on Aklis after all these years, and she'd be a fool to waste this opportunity. As Sullivan started his work on the tabs, Lisbeth opened the freezer and removed the first drill sample, the cylinder shaking in her unsteady grasp. Their ship was called Odyssey, a standard UT-800, a boat for small crews. He'd cased it, walking through the rooms with a wave of dread surging in his stomach. Nothing about the vessel screamed rescue specialists. There were no weapons stores on board, no heavy artillery. The crew had severely underestimated what they would find on Aklis. He'd checked their comm transcripts, too. They'd told Hevitz they'd landed. Nothing else. Hevitz hadn't responded, but a delay was standard this far into the fringe. In fact, it was unlikely the crew's first message had even reached its destination yet. They'd visit the drilling stations, he reasoned. It was only a matter of time. He should have moved the engineer's body. He should have washed away the warning. He should have done so many things he hadn't, but it had been a long time since he believed help might be coming, and he'd grown sloppy. The boy considered if it was worth turning things on again, sending a drill bit down, down, down into Aklis's depths. It might serve as a solid distraction from the truth. But it could also awaken that darkness again, bring devils to the surface. A new possibility dawned on him. He considered leaving this rock, starting over. His food stores were almost gone, and there was the reason he'd joined Black Quarry to begin with, an objective he might still be able to complete. He reviewed plans mentally until he found the one with the best chance of success. Perfect execution would be key, and with any luck, the crew could be his ticket off-planet. He'd just have to convince them to take him. He'd have to lie, and he was okay with that. He'd done a lot, lot worse. 4. The Grave. Black Quarry Drilling Base, Aklis, Fringe 1 System. Showing what Toby thought might be her first bit of foresight since landing, Dylan refused to leave Sullivan and the doctor without transportation. The result was a very crowded ride to the drilling site. Toby sat crammed in the back of Rover One with Nova and the intern, bouncing and jolting as the vehicle navigated the harsh terrain. Dylan drove about as aggressively as she had when she transported them from Odyssey to Celestial Envoy, lots of sudden braking and harsh acceleration. Even Cleaver, who sat in the spacious front passenger seat and was almost impossible to shake, had a hand braced against the window frame. There were no tracks to follow. Probably they'd been swept away in the storms Tarlo had mentioned. Their destination flashed on the dashboard navigational system, but when Toby searched the horizon, Ocles was nothing but murky shadow beyond the glow of the rover's headlights. They bucked over a particularly rough patch of ground, and Nova was not quick enough to brace her hands against the seat in front of her. Her helmet bounced off the seat, and she cursed enthusiastically.
"If we die on this planet, we'll be just like the Black Quarry crew," Toby said, "and Hevitz will still get what they want."
"What does that mean?" the intern asked. He side-eyed her through his helmet. For someone so smart, she sure was ignorant.
"The Carrarium? They found it, so what do they care if the entire crew died? They've got an untapped vein, nope, planet, of Carrarium to stake their claim in."
"But they can't possibly want their crew dead," the intern went on.
"True, but I doubt they really care, either. Remember the underwater hab that breached on Eutheria last year? 4 dozen drillers and technicians crushed by the pressure of the Paxica Ocean, and Hevitz didn't bat an eye. They settled lawsuits and paid off families and kept right on drilling. The Carrarium harvested far outweighed their legal fees, especially when the Union keeps throwing grants and funding their way. It's always about the bottom dollar."
"So why do you work for them?" she countered. "Why work for a company you clearly despise and think is unethical?"
"They pay well," Toby answered with a shrug.
"Ah," the intern said, cocking up those 2 thick eyebrows. "So it's all about the bottom dollar." Nova smirked.
"Okay, so maybe the intern was sharp after all." "You want to know what I really think about all this?" Toby said.
"Please, no,"
Nova groaned.
"I think Hevitz is in a powerful position, and they better act before it's too late. Before there's no Trios to call home."
The intern's face pinched up.
"Toby's convinced we're gonna get ourselves blown up,"
Nova explained.
"That if the radicals don't commit to their cause, and instead keep running these weakly backed export strikes, the Cradle won't even bother intervening. They'll just give the order to blow the Trios to stardust." "That'd be counterproductive," Toby said. "We've got the Carrarium. They're not going to blow us up when they need us to mine and export it."
"I don't see how the radicals expect to accomplish anything when their last strike failed after 24 hours, Thea said.
"Because the military intervened,"
he countered. Clearly an unfair advantage, but the intern didn't look convinced.
"Look, this entire universe is due for a shakeup," he went on, "and it's coming whether we like it or not. Hell, it already happened over in F2, on Casey. Those fringe colonists fought for independence a few years back, and they don't even have Carrarium. Granted, that's probably why the Union let them cut loose. There's nothing to be gained from that rock. Still, those colonists understood how important independence is. They knew they were better off relying on the Earth-era energies they had than dealing with the UPC. If we don't follow suit, and fast, the Union is going to step in and fire every government official serving in the Trios and replace them with their own loyal lapdogs till our little paradise of a system is completely at their mercy and we have no chance at independence."
He paused for dramatic effect, then added,
"That is, unless the radicals get their act together first and stage a coup from within."
"How?" The intern actually laughed, the noise jolting as the rover pitched over a series of ruts.
The last distribution strike was ended by our own military vessels. Vessels that serve the Trios, but also the Union. That's how powerful the Union is, Toby. It stretches across systems and planets, has ties within every level of any organization, and has been growing since the colonization of New Earth.
Sort of like the Radicals, he countered. They've been growing since we founded the Trios, infiltrating key positions and public offices, and even serving in the Trios military. We've got our own fleet, just like the Cradle. They all serve the Union, but if enough Trios ships defect, they could stage one hell of a revolution.
And start one hell of a war, the intern argued.
Not if they manage to get Hevitz on board first. Now that the company's found an uncolonized rock that's possibly rich with corarium, they can hold Achilles, cease drilling in the Trios, maybe even destroy the wells there. Exports to the Cradle will run out, and then we've got the Union officials right where we want them. The Trios can renegotiate taxes and regulations, and if all else fails, we just cut them off. Regain our independence.
God, your dedication to conspiracy theories is riveting, Toby. Truly,
Nova said. He smirked behind his helmet. Debating with Nova was so much easier than the intern. All he had to do was strike a nerve, and the pilot lashed back with personal attacks and emotion. He always knew he was winning when her pretty face went dark with anger.
Do you even realize how far-fetched that is?
Nova went on.
How much brain power did you dedicate to dreaming that up?
Just think about it, Nova,
he said. For one tiny moment, try to imagine that Hevitz might not be our friend.
I want independence as much as the next radical, but we might end up being sacrificed in order to secure it.
Not everyone even wants independence,
Nova spat.
I tend to like the protection we get being in the UPC. People die when there's war. My father died trying to calm the uprisings on Casey a few years back, and...
She exhaled hard.
That's not why we're here, Toby. It's just not.
Toby shrugged, unswayed.
No one set foot on Achilles since Witch Hazel, but now Hevitz is suddenly interested again. They've lost contact with the Black Quarry crew and, let's be honest, seen a fucking terrifying SOS. But they still told us to case their ship and sent another crew to follow up. That sounds like they're protecting an investment to me. You don't put that much energy into something unless it's going to pay off tenfold later.
It's all about the bottom dollar, the intern quipped.
Nova smirked beside her.
Go ahead and laugh,
Toby said. Just remember that I don't want to be right on this. Not this time. 'Cause if I am, we're all in a bad place.
Almost there,
Dylan called from the front. Thea squinted, trying to make out anything in the poor lighting. Through the windshield, she could see what looked like a steep crater, or perhaps just a gully. Whatever the obstacle, the Black Quarry crew had erected a bridge to cross it, and the ride was momentarily blessedly smooth. Then the rover bumped back onto the terrain, and it was more bucking and pitching. A few meters ahead, and barely visible in the vehicle's headlights, was a squat, one-story structure. The drilling base, Thea assumed. For all the talk of it being positioned along a canyon, there was no sign of one. Maybe it was on the opposite side of the building, hidden from view.
We go on foot from here,
Dylan said, tugging on the emergency brake. She cracked her door, only to have the wind wrench it fully open. Thea put a hand on Rover One for balance when she exited the vehicle. Dirt and pebbles pinged against her suit.
Incoming storm?
Nova screamed over the din.
Could be,
Dylan yelled back.
We better be quick.
Dr. Tarlow had mentioned that strong winds were a constant, so Thea tried to remind herself that this gale blowing from the west might be perfectly normal, harmless, even. But she'd never had to work so hard to simply walk. As they approached the drilling base, Toby's words echoed in her mind.
I don't want to be right on this.
Thea didn't want him to be either. because as much as she hated to admit it, this was one of Toby's theories that seemed based in reality, at least somewhat. For as long as Thea could remember, the Trios had been angling for independence from the United Planetary Coalition. "Unity does not equal freedom" was spray-painted on a dumpster behind the foster home in Hearth City, and the even shorter "not equal" sign constantly appeared on subway cars and billboards. The Trios had needed the Union's assistance once, back when the system was first founded, but that was eons ago. Rich with Corarium, they were now self-sufficient, and also required to provide Corarium to all colonized planets in the Cradle under the UPC's Responsible Energy Statute. In theory, the law was sound. If sustainable energy sources exist, they should be used whenever and wherever possible to extend the life of Union planets and avoid over-harvesting as seen during Earth era. But the pro-independence mindset thought of the Cradle as freeloaders, leeching off the Trios's Corarium and not paying nearly enough for the precious resource. With the failed export strike behind them, maybe the Radicals had approached Aldrich Vastenur. No one really knew what direction the new owner intended to take Hevitt's Industries, and it was possible he was protecting an investment, like Toby had implied. The thought terrified Thea. What did the Radicals think would happen if they staged a coup and managed to hold Corarium reserves hostage? That the Union would let the Trios secede peacefully? It was laughable. The Trios and Cradle militaries were evenly matched, but the Trios would never be allowed to cut loose. And even if the Trios did somehow manage to win independence through a war, what would they lose in exchange for it? Most ship manufacturers were based in the Cradle, as were a decent number of farm corporations, which produced invaluable vaccines and had patents on med gear. Would these things still be affordable to Trio citizens once they were no longer in the UPC? Travel visas could be banned, too, making an attendance at Linnaeus Institute impossible for Trio's citizens like Thea. And that wasn't even considering the complications that could arise from Union loyalists within the Trios, many of whom were bound to be in military positions. It was a giant, nightmarish mess, and Thea prayed Toby was wrong. He had to be, because the alternative wasn't pretty. A particularly strong gust of wind sent Thea jogging sideways, and she righted her course, focusing her attention on the building ahead. Up close, the drilling base looked a lot like Northwood Point's hangar, plain, dark, and unadorned, save for the Hevitt's logo painted across the sliding door. Dylan and Cleaver hauled it open, and the group crossed the threshold, finally protected from the wind. In the span of a few steps, Thea's body felt half as heavy, the world twice as quiet. She brought up her stun gun, flashlight held alongside it, as she scanned the dark. What she found was an equipment graveyard, rovers and forklifts and utility cases spread throughout the hangar. The floor was divided like a giant yellow and white checkerboard, and each piece of equipment sat in a numbered space, aisles and rows cutting between them. A central aisle, wider than all the others and covered in muddy boot prints, cut straight for the rear of the garage. Nova used her rifle to point at it repeatedly, jerking her head for emphasis. Thea looked again. It wasn't mud. It was blood. Or maybe a mix of both. Dylan snapped her weapon up, the mounted light following the prints. Something groaned in the rear of the garage. The crew froze, all their lights snapping toward the sound. There it was again. A low groan, a high-pitched squeak, then a bang. It repeated, the iteration uneven, like someone was dragging a pickaxe across the floor, lifting it and slamming it against the walls. Dylan sidestepped into a row of machinery, leaving the bloody footprints in favor of a narrow row of forklifts. She skirted between them, weapon at the ready, moving silently toward the sound. The others trailed after her, fanning out into other aisles. Thea forced herself to follow. The flashlights made the forklifts cast long, sharp shadows, which shrank and expanded as the crew continued forward. Thea kept looking behind her, mistaking the flickering shadows for life. The rows of equipment finally ended, the far wall of the hangar glinting under the crew's lights. And then movement to the left. A long, horrible creak. Thea swiveled toward the noise. A door slammed shut. Wind somehow caught it, throwing it open again, so that it swung on its hinges, groaning for a second, before banging shut another time. Dylan ran forward, propping the door open with her foot, as she scanned beyond with her weapon. Thea crept nearer, and when she got a glimpse of what waited past the doorway, the wind suddenly made sense. The drilling base had indeed been constructed along the rim of the canyon, and here the door opened onto a ravine so narrow Thea could easily make out the far side. Beyond the door was a small landing and a set of graded stairs that snaked downward. She knew the structure would have to be strong to withstand Achilles' storms, but it looked like little more than scaffolding.
"Found the reactor!"
Cleaver shouted from inside.
"It's not running!"
Thea backed away from the door and followed Dylan in the direction of Cleaver's voice until the portable Corarium reactor came into view. Every ship in the Trios was powered by one, and most remote research posts and drilling excursions used them too. It was the energy Hevitz was drilling for, contained in a box and powering the whole of the Black Quarry operation. The large alloy cube was positioned in the rear corner of the garage, maybe 3 meters tall and just as wide and deep. Bolts and couplings secured the container in place, and warning labels were plastered on every surface. Pipes and tubing ran from the reactor through the rear wall of the garage, connecting to what Thea could only assume would be the drilling equipment below. Northwood Point had a portable Corarium reactor, too, but it was secured in a dedicated room somewhere on the administrative side of the research facility. Thea had never seen it, but she knew the PCR provided them their every convenience, only to be shut off in favor of antiquated backup power in the cases of extreme storms. There was nothing more dangerous than a damaged reactor. They were in a critical state even while running normally. But with damage, a breach, the smallest hiccup, Thea took a step backward.
"Should I reboot it?"
Cleaver nodded at a series of breakers along the wall.
"Not with a chance of a storm,"
Nova argued. "It's go through that door and climb down 2 dozen flights to the drill deck," Dylan said, "or take the elevator." She pointed to a panel of metal fencing. Beyond it, Thea could see an empty car waiting in the shaft. "The reactor's got a built-in failsafe. It'll power down if the storm gets too intense, but right now, time is of the essence." Dylan walked to the elevator and slid open the gate.
"Power it up, Cleaver."
Toby leaned against the wall as the car ratcheted down, the thrum of the reactor fading. A flash of yellow light outside the fenced gating announced each new level. This was all decidedly bad. Another intact reactor, bloody footprints, no survivors. He stretched his neck, feeling antsy. Toby wanted the uprising, the fight back, the reclaiming of their system. He'd be happy if this Black Quarry gig wasn't only about the bottom dollar, but independence, too. But that, in itself, was part of the problem. Because if Hevitz's presence on this bleak, deserted rock was as complicated as Toby expected, well, so long as the company assumed control of the place in the end, they wouldn't care much if Odyssey's crew disappeared, just like Black Quarry's. The elevator came to an abrupt halt. Dylan threw the door open to reveal the drilling tier. Steam hissed and sputtered. Toby stepped from the elevator and onto a narrow catwalk. Waist-high railings ran along the length that bordered the chasm, and just 10 meters or so across the yawning gap, he could make out the opposite ravine wall. One look through the graded catwalk surface, and Toby felt slightly dizzy. Black. Nothing but darkness, as far as he could see. But it had to end somewhere.
This was the drill deck, after all.
Bumped and prodded as the others filed out of the elevator, Toby brushed against a series of pipes that ran along the chasm wall. Steam rippled from them. He couldn't feel anything through his suit, but the pipes were clearly heating up. Another catwalk was suspended overhead, but like the chasm wall behind him, it seemed to serve no purpose other than to support pipes and tubing.
"Drill sites 1 through 5 are to the left," Dylan said, pointing down the catwalk. 6 through 10 to the right, and I'll check those with Nova. You three, case the others."
She tossed a handheld radio to Cleaver.
"Swiped those from the rover. Radio if you find anything."
With the intercoms down, it would be their only method of communication once the groups separated. Dylan and Cleaver picked a channel and tested the radios. The audio crackled lightly.
"I don't really think we should split up," the intern argued, but Dylan had already grabbed Nova at the triceps, leading her off toward drill sites 6 through 10.
"Let's just get this over with," Toby said, giving Cleaver a prod in the back. "The sooner we're out of this dank hellhole, the better."
Thea was sick of bringing up the rear. She followed Cleaver and Toby down the catwalk and away from the elevator, knowing arguing would make no difference. Cleaver was the skilled security detail. He should go first. And Toby, well, she knew how highly he thought of interns. The external temperature readings in her visor flicked from negative 12 degrees Celsius to negative 11. Now that the reactor was up and running, the piping beside her was giving off some heat. Not that she could feel any of it. Her suit was a pleasant 20 degrees and had been since stepping off Odyssey.
"Drill point up ahead," Cleaver called.
She jogged after the men, leaving the catwalk for a half-moon landing that extended out over the chasm. In its center, the drilling apparatus stood like a stoic obelisk, extending below the landing and out of sight. The wellheads surrounding it all bore a stenciled 5. Toby leaned over a waist-high railing that made up the perimeter of the landing, and Thea joined him there, scanning over the edge. Something twinkled at the bottom of the narrow ravine. Water, she realized, just a story or two below them. The icy river cut through the channel, flowing from east to west. It appeared almost black, taking on the color of the dark earth surrounding it. Odd, Thea thought to herself. In only very few instances was corarium found in lake beds or river deltas, but the Black Quarry engineers must have determined this to be the best location to drill. That, or perhaps weather on the night side was too intense to risk drilling through the ice sheets to access Ackley's ocean. Without seeing their data, it was impossible to know. Dr. Tarlow's warning echoed in Thea's mind.
"We should thoroughly evaluate all the logs before we go running into some canyon where contaminated matter might have been drilled."
She backed away from the railing. Cleaver made a circular motion with his finger, wrapping up their work on the landing, and they moved on. About halfway between drill sites 5 and 4, the stairwell from the garage joined the catwalk. It was covered in the same bloody footprints from above, only the prints were now subtle and smeared.
"Rain could have washed them away,"
Cleaver suggested. He tilted his rifle back, shining the light through the gaps in the overhead catwalk.
"Let's radio Dylan," Thea said. "Tell her the prints lead to this level."
"It's nothing she doesn't already know about," Toby responded. "She saw those prints leading down the stairs, and she's just gonna tell us to keep sweeping and call if we find survivors."
Cleaver shrugged in agreement, but drawled sarcastically as they pressed on.
"Follow the bloody footprints," they said. "What could go wrong?" they said.
Thea fanned at the steam coming off the pipes as they continued. Between the light on her helmet and her flashlight, navigating the catwalk had become as treacherous as driving through thick fog with high beams engaged. Their lights were only making things worse. She trained her weapon and flashlight down, letting the light fall near her feet, and used Toby's small frame as guidance. At each drilling point, she eagerly stepped onto the landing, momentarily escaping the onslaught of steam. Cleaver scanned the deck and overhead catwalks, while Toby and Thea leaned over the railing to check the service ladders that ran down around the drill. By the time they reached the final drilling point, the footprints had long since been scrubbed clean from the catwalk. Cleaver grumbled something unintelligible as he stepped onto the landing, rolling his eyes. Thea wished she could feel as frustrated, as disappointed. Instead, she felt only a clawing, uneasy dread in her stomach. It wasn't as if there were tons of places where the Black Quarry crew could have retreated for safety. If the crew's survivors weren't on Celestial Envoy or here at the drill site...
Over here! Toby yelled. Holy shit, get over here!
Thea bolted across the landing to join him, adding her light to the beam he'd already projected downward. And there, at the bottom of the chasm, piled high in the Achilles River, lay the remains of the Black Quarry crew. And not just one or two of them, but presumably all of them. There were too many to easily count. Not a single person wore a spacesuit or helmet. Instead, they were in standard work clothes, mechanic coveralls, or medic uniforms, their exposed skin blistered with cold.
Oh my God,
Cleaver breathed. Thea scanned the mass of frozen flesh as best she could, her pulse spiking in her visor. Only a few of the bodies were face up, and their eyes were closed as though they were merely sleeping.
Why would the crew move their deceased here?
Toby asked, still staring at the atrocity.
Isn't there an incinerator on Celestial Envoy? Cleaver added.
Yeah, that'd be a hell of a lot easier than dragging them all this way.
No one moved them, Thea said. They walked here themselves. We saw their footprints.
Impossible!
Toby shook his head.
No suits or provisions? It's a death wish. They'd be condemning themselves.
Maybe they were sick. Maybe whatever they caught messed with their heads.
And then they just fell asleep in their watery trench grave? I mean, their eyes are closed,
Toby said, throwing a hand at the bodies.
That suggests they either died in their sleep or someone closed their lids for them and then moved them here, which, again, makes precisely zero sense.
Only one way to know for sure, Cleaver said. We take a body back for autopsy.
No way, Thea spat. That pile is at least 100 bodies deep, some drenched in water that could be contaminated. And you want to go get one of them? After you saw the state of Celestial Envoy? After Evans's message? It got in us? No, we shouldn't touch anything.
Clearly not fond of being ordered around by someone half his age, Cleaver snatched the radio from his waistband.
Found deceased crew members, he said. Advise.
Confirm their status, came Dylan's choppy reply. If dead, haul one up so we can transport it to...
She cut out, overwhelmed by static. Thea looked up to the sky. Clouds were gathering, angry and heavy.
Storm must be interfering.
Well, you heard Dylan,
Cleaver said, tucking the radio away.
Let's go fishing.
He located a first aid case bolted to one of the landing's rail posts and wrestled it open, pulling free a body bag. Thea shuddered. The life of a driller was never a safe one. They lost their lives on occasion. But this? Here on Achilles? Presumably every member of the drilling crew had died. Every scientist and maintenance worker and company official, from pilot to mess cook, had lost their life. There wouldn't be enough body bags for them all.
I still don't think we should do this, Thea said.
We're in full gear, Toby argued. And besides, what do you propose? We wait for Dylan to show up and tear us a new one? We're not waiting.
Cleaver said, reaching over the railing to grab the harness and belay system used to service the drilling shaft.
She probably started running this way as soon as we radioed, and I sure as hell am gonna have a body hauled up by the time she gets here. Ah, shit.
He glanced up from the harness, which didn't have enough belt for his wide frame.
Damn greaseheads. Just because they have to be small and fit in tight places doesn't mean every harness should be sized to fit girls.
Toby, who wasn't much larger than Thea, rolled his eyes.
Well, which of you is gonna go?
No one should go, is what I'm saying, Thea argued.
You then, Tobes?
Of course me, he snarled. Dylan will have both our heads if we let an intern handle something this important.